We've got a guest coming. We've been talking about him a lot tonight, of course. This is Conspiracy Worldwide, conspiracyblog.net. As we introduce now, our next guest tonight, Saul Williams. Let's bring him in.
Hello.
Hello, Saul Williams. Welcome to the Friday Night Live Show.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for taking the time out. It's an absolute pleasure. We've got over 125 countries listened in now, so you can understand it's amazing to have the man himself on. We're going to be talking tonight then throughout the interview, talking about your career from all the sides, yourself as a poet, musician, writer, performer. We're going to be covering all angles. And to do that, I hand you over then to my co-host, Menace.
Peace. How you doing, Saul?
Great, man. How are you?
Good. Yeah, pretty good. Pretty good. And there's so many ways and directions that I could start with this interview, but I think I'm going to start by asking you this question. I mean, as such a multi-talented artist, I mean, how would you categorize your calling as an artist? And at which point did it first hit you? And how did you understand that calling?
Well, at first, you know, I've answered many callings. You know, when I was young, I wanted to be an actor. And I also wanted to, I started rapping and I started breakdancing and I was into all of those things. And I knew, you know, I told my parents that I wanted to be an actor, but that's because I could study acting. But there were other things that I wanted to do that I couldn't officially study. And so all of those things started bleeding into each other over time. And I guess my whole process has been a time of developing a relationship with my gut, you know, with my intuition and following, you know, my heart and mind and spirit as it's led me. I mean, I've never studied poetry, for instance, and I didn't start writing poetry as poetry, really, until I was in graduate school for acting. And I assumed that I'd be, pursuing a career as an actor, which I've done to a certain extent, but most of my energy and focus in recent years has been more so on making poetry. And both of those things have come of somewhat of a surprise for me. I mean, I made music as a kid, but I gave it up when I was younger. I just never expected to be doing most of the stuff that I'm doing. And so I discovered, you know, that point of answering that calling. I discover it daily because there are new callings daily.
Okay, I mean, having started your many modes of expression as an actor, how would you say acting has helped you discover traits within yourself as both an artist and a man?
Well, I would say that acting has been crucial, which is strange to say as I'm talking to you from Hollywood, California, you know, because the acting that I studied and the acting that has benefited me has not been necessarily the acting that I necessarily happening in my experience, you know, in front of a camera here. It's been most of the stuff that I discovered on stage when I was in school studying it, you know, through studying other characters. I was forced to raise questions for myself and discover interesting new characteristics about myself, you know. And so that in many ways, acting and role-playing supplied a certain level of experience that I had not actually had in real life, but in my acting self, I had traveled. And so I did a lot of my first traveling through role-playing, through being in plays and what have you, and then with time, you know, I actually started getting some passes on my passport and what have you, but I would say that acting opened my eyes to a lot of things within and outside of myself and essentially blazed the path for me to find it. You know, I think of acting sort of like it can be like a martial art form, you know, like Tao and the art of archery or something in that form, and that you are, your goal in wanting to become a character is essentially, it's a focus on being. You know, and our highest compliment that we pay an actor is such and such became, or so and so is. Jamie Foxx is Ray Charles. You know, we make that he's playing Ray Charles to he is him. He has become him. That is the essence of it. You know, and so supposedly through acting, you know, you master it by finding the essence of this person. But in real life, what you're aiming to master can only be found through mastering the essence of yourself. You know, and so acting mirrors that in that way. But it can also probably be very misleading if you spend a lot of time acting and not a lot of time being.
That's very interesting. And I mean, what about this experience with your acting and its connection with your writing and music? I mean, how would you say your experience and training as an actor has translated into the style of your writing and music?
Well, it's not so much into the style. My training as an actor has granted me a few gifts. One has been just in realizing the significance of having a presence, you know, like that's another way that we compliment an actor, like a James Earl Jones, for example. We say, oh, he has such a strong presence. And all it means is that this person, when they walk into a room, they have such a strong sense of self that even you feel it, that you're forced to acknowledge their presence, their being, you know?
Right.
And that's something that you bring to stage, and that's something that some bring to life. Interestingly, when it's done well on stage, we compliment it by saying he brought it to life, you know? Mm. And so it's acting has helped me in that way. And then the other way that it's helped me in terms of, and that's more so, I see that expressed like in just standing in front of people and being comfortable in front of people. It's helped me in that way. But then there's also the role-playing side, the fact that, you know, I don't feel like, you know, any sort of rock star or Niggy Tardas or any of this, you know, this persona that is,
right,
you know, connected to the music. I don't necessarily feel like that. It's developing a character, I guess can be likened to like developing a persona, and many artists do it, you know, and especially within the realm of music, you know, and I guess I discovered for myself that when I wrote music, it came from a particular place, and that I could make more sense of that place if I gave that place a name and gave that character a name, and you know, and let it exist within that realm, and that's, I guess, some way that acting has help me make sense of that.
So what you're saying is that Niggy Tardas isn't all of you. It's just a part of you. This is what makes Saul Williams.
Yeah, it's a part of it. And that's just an album. I mean, the album that I'm writing now, it, you know, feels very much like me and is completely, you know, I have a different task, you know, in that I want to share, you know, the essence of myself as opposed to the twisted, you know, bombastic side or whatever. You know, there's so many different sides to invest in that anyone has, you know.
Right. We're going to get to the new album. We're going to talk about the new album a little later on. But I'd like to know about the influences. Let's talk about some of the voices who helped shape Saul Williams as an artist. I mean, who would be some of the voices, both dead and voices contemporary with yourself, who helped you find your voice?
Lots of artists. I would have to say first my dad, even if I wouldn't want to admit that, part of me doesn't. My dad was extremely eloquent and was a very interesting man to listen to and communicate with. And he was a minister. And of course, I spent a lot of time growing up listening to him speak and orate and all this stuff. And found it pretty intriguing. And so there's that, you know, and then there's old figures like Paul Robeson or or Martin Luther King or Malcolm X or Amiri Baraka or The Last Poets or Gil Scott-Heron, figures from the past like that, you know, that through the test of time have raised their voices, sort of like this male siren, you know, this griot that speaks up, you know, and contemplates aloud, you know, the necessity of hardship and all these things. Have been like, I've heard some of those voices in music, some in poetry, you know, some in theater, you know, and some I've just read and imagined, you know, or in recordings of old speeches or any of that stuff, you know, so people like that. And then you know, contemporary wise, you know, that as a kid, you know, if you asked me then, my first answer before anything else I said would have been the rappers I listened to, you know, which were at that time the Rakim, KRS-One, Run DMC, LL Cool J, just Public Enemy, Organized Confusion, Tribe Called Quest, Outkast, what else? Cypress Hill, Goody Mob, Ultramagnetic MCs, Jungle Brothers, De La Soul, all of that stuff. Del the Funky Homo Sapiens, Souls of Mischief, Black Sheep. I grew up listening really hard to all of that stuff in hip hop that really, really, you know, gave me a palette to work from as far as, you know, just flavorful language and fun and bounciness and ways of, you know, riding a beat and all this stuff, you know, this Wu-Tang and now, you know, cats like T.I. and Lil Wayne. Who else do I like? Gosh, there's so many people. Bjork and Tom York and Radiohead and, you know, what else? Portishead, the Mars Volta at the drive-in, Queens of the Stone Age, Rat-a-tat-tat, Rio and Maggio, TV on the Radio, Mew, Elbow, Muse, Sufjan Stevens, Cat Power, Georgia Ann Muldrow, Madlib, you know, like all those cats. Everybody that I bump, I really enjoy. Classic stuff, you know, like Funkadelic and Can and Jimi Hendrix and James Brown and Betty Davis and Miles Davis and Train and Thelonious Monk, Nina Simone, The Beatles, lots of music, literature. I mean, like one of the authors that was really important for me finding my voice, I would say, is the Nigerian author Ben Okri, Alice Walker, Ayn Rand, Octavia Butler, Samuel Delaney, let's see, Carlos Fuentes, who else? Eduardo Galeano, of course, people like James Baldwin and Maya Angelou, of course, people like Shakespeare and Herman Hesse and filmmakers and actors, people like Sean Penn, people like Jim Jarmusch, people like Gong Li, people like Gael Garcia or what is it, Diego Luna, so many people. I mean, it's just, you know, Woody Allen, there's so much, great art to be inspired by. Visual artists, you know, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Picasso, Van Gogh, André Bermatoyer, Marcia Jones, Kara Walker, Sanford Biggers. Wow, there's a lot of inspiring work out there.
And these, and of course, these are all people that have helped pave the way. And Infinite Machine was an artist at the man today. And I mean, when you often talk about your evolution as a and journey as a poet and a term poet in interviews, and understanding the time it takes to become a poet. My question is, at which point did you see yourself as a poet personally?
At what point did I see myself as a poet?
Personally, right. I'm just saying that.
Personally.
Right, right.
Let's say today, right now, this is the first time. And I'm serious. I haven't, you know, until now. I think that life kind of, you know, conspires some sort of, you know, symphony that crescendos to a point of understanding. And my, you know, point break is probably about now, you know. Isn't it Good Friday?
Yeah, you know, that's right. It is. Yeah.
You know, yeah. I haven't, you know, I didn't call myself a poet for a long time. I have felt as if a poet is a beautiful thing to be called, but it felt more like an arrogant thing to call yourself, you know? So anytime anyone has called me that, my response is usually, thank you. Thank you for referring to me as that. Because I don't know if I've had the strength to refer myself is there.
I mean, given the current chaotic state of the world and, you know, times of such social misery, and you having obviously such a unique ability, you know, and honesty to quest for the truth in your work, how would you categorize, rather, your spirituality? Where does it come from? Where's the root?
You know, the same place all the other roots are underground, you know? That's where the roots are. You know, I was raised in a Christian church and, you know, at some point realized that I could learn, you know, easily see the difference between what God, you know, or the universe or creation would intend for us and what was man-made, you know, and deciphering between, you know, what I could feel from what I was taught and what was being imposed upon me, you know? The idea of being told to fear, you know, God and thinking of God as angry or jealous or, you know, or thinking of oneself as in any elitist way, you know, thinking of oneself or one group in as any elitist way, as if God would reflect the sort of prejudice that we, you know, inject into our, you know, mainstream here, as if God would reflect that, as if, no, you are my chosen, you are not. You know, I at some point I had to say, oh, okay, religion is a crutch, but you can't walk with crutches your entire life, because then, you know, your musculature will never develop. You never fully learn to walk. If you break your leg, the doctor will give you crutches. You know, but at some point you have to take the cast off and let the crutches go and walk so that the muscles and bones will develop properly, you know? And at some point you have to put down your crutches individually. I made that choice years ago. But that doesn't mean, you know, the act of actually giving up one's crutches is not the same as letting go of all of the mental and invisible crutches that we still hold on to because we feel the need to, because we can, because nothing in this world has really simply taught us how to be free.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, moving forward a little bit, in your book, The Dead MC Scrolls, you talk about the influence and effect those scrolls had on you in helping you find your voice as an MC and a poet and an artist, of course. Had you not found those scrolls, how do you think your rhyming and writing would have been different today?
Well, the Dead MC Scrolls is a is what I term as metafiction. It's the point where what we create becomes us.
Okay.
You know? And so that it's beyond reality to the point of breaking back into reality. And so the story of the scrolls is a metaphor. And what I'm trying to convey is essentially that I feel spoken through, that I don't feel like I've written everything that's come out of me. You know, I feel like I've been trying to decipher something, you know, an emotion, a way of being, a way of seeing, and have had to, you know, subject myself to awkward stances and ways of holding my pen and pad in order to get those things out.
Right.
Because once again, nothing around me has necessarily invited me to be so open. You know, like, and what I mean by nothing around me is that most people, most that I encounter have enveloped some level of belief that, let's say, allows them to condone something as simple as eating meat without thinking about it. You know?
I mean, you're saying,
you know.
Sorry, carry on. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I just was curious as to what you meant behind the statement in this book. You said, I believe it was something to the extent of, a lot of people are going to be frustrated. A lot of people are going to be mad when you come out with this book. What did you mean by that?
I was creating a sense of drama.
Okay. Okay.
that's you know, like I was in a meeting with my literary agent today, and she told me that, you know, three things sell, like sex, death, and gosh, what was the third one? And and the Dead and Sea Scrolls, you know, was my way of taking a book of poetry that I felt represented a perspective that was as detached from my ego as I could get it, and finding a way to serve it. You know, it's like if you have a kid and you want your kid to eat some broccoli or kale or spinach, you know, or something like that, and the kid just isn't into it because he's surrounded by kids reading hot dogs and Twinkies and all this other stuff, and he's like, why are we different, you know? Maybe you have to find a creative way to get that kid to eat the kale.
Got you.
The Dead MC Scrolls was essentially that. It was me trying to find a creative way to get kids to eat kale.
Genius. That brings me to my next question in the book. You also say that after encountering a text, you began to listen to hip-hop differently. Now, comparing that period of time to today, how have your feelings towards hip-hop have changed, you know, culturally and musically, if you were to compare that period of time to today?
Wait, what was the first period that you referred to?
When you wrote the book, you said that you were feeling... You said that these texts made you listen to hip-hop differently.
Yes. And so listening now, what do I think? Well, you know,
compared to
those ears with which I listen to hip-hop differently still exist. You know, like there is still a prevailing mentality, you know, and that's not just hip-hop. It's just, you know, like it was interesting to watch how hip-hop was born because so many of us saw so much in it, so much potential. You know, like it almost immediately became politicized, you know, and used as, you know, the voice of the disenfranchised and what have you. And so when hip-hop started taking different turns and voicing something different, you know, becoming the voice of, you know, the man you know, staring all night at the stripper or what have you. A lot of people like myself became a little disillusioned, like, is this all we're doing with this now? But it's interesting because, you know, creation is infinite and you can't really control where or how things grow or blossom. Like, I have two kids and I want and wish and work for the best for them. But at the end of the day, they will make their own decisions and will determine what and how they become. You know?
Mm. Mm.
And hip hop is not my kid, you know, it's me. You know, and if it's not me, then it's like my brother, you know. But it's me, actually. It's my twin brother. And it is what it is, essentially. You know, I respect it for what it is, and if it's just a matter of it having its moments. I mean, most MCs that I know don't even feel like rhyming anymore. So, so half of the dialogue about hip-hop isn't even worthwhile because cats aren't feeling that bug like they used to, you know? Mm-hmm. Cats don't really want to listen to real spit like they used to. They don't want to listen. They want to listen to something a little different. And most cats I know who usually deliver those rhymes are like, I'm thinking about singing. Look at Lil Wayne. Look at Kanye. You know, like, cats want to sing, which is wonderful. And so, and if that is the evolution of hip-hop, that says something amazing because there's so much vulnerability in singing. There's so much more openness that exists there. And for the cats that want to rhyme, you know, like, you'll always conjure whatever you put over a beat. Mm. That's real simple. That's real simpious. You know, like, that's just how it goes down. You know, like, D.I.G., ready to die, boom, dead. You know, Pac said he never had a criminal record until he said that he did on record. You know, like, the power of hip-hop just is the power of hip-hop. If people choose to misuse that power, then we'll see, you know, more rappers getting caught up, serving a sentence for not realizing the power of the word.
It's definitely something, yeah, like you said, that power is definitely something that's underestimated today. And I think while we're talking about evolution, it might be interesting to note that Adisa Banjoko, what did he say? He said something on a show a while back about hip-hop's growth. And he basically explained it, described it as being, metaphorically speaking, hip-hop, this thing that lived on a couch and never left the couch. You know, it got lazy. I mean, how do you feel about a statement like that coming from somebody as, you know, influential as Adisa today? I mean, is it dangerous saying that?
I think that that's an adequate statement. Yeah, it did get kind of lazy.
Right.
It got kind of dick and lazy. That's pretty much what it is.
You could even argue that the same thing's going on today with rappers sinning, as you just said, and not wanting to MC.
Yeah.
I mean, but what about this? We both know that.
You remember that hip hop is just a reflection of a lot of things, you know, and in many ways, it's been mostly a reflection of U.S. culture, you know, en masse. That's what hip hop has been reflecting, you know. Mm. When we were voting for Bush, that was the same time we were voting for Jay-Z and 50, you know, like, in 50 has the same birthday as George Bush and. You know, and Jay raps like a Republican, you know, for the most part. I love him. I think he's super talented. But, you know, I'm talking about as far as the positions on money. You know, only now I think he's shifting, you know, and realizing the importance of that shift. And I don't know for that. And I think that, you know, it's, you know, it's, that's inevitable anyway.
Mm.
You know, people realizing the power of what's going down is inevitable.
What about this? We both know that hip-hop is an African-American art form, but for our listeners who don't, how is hip-hop African, specifically? In the words of Saul.
You said, how is it African?
How, right, yeah. I mean, from source perspective, not generically speaking, I mean, how does it root back for our listeners that don't know?
The way, you know, the way that I would put it is, and I wouldn't, you know, hip hop is African, like everything is African. You know, like we all have our roots in a common place on this planet, so it seems. You know, if we learn different, then we'll teach different from what we know now, you know, and from what we can sense and what we can tell, that seems to be the case. Okay. So hip hop is in all, you know, in that interconnected way of the same family root and center. Above and beyond that, you know, what I think it represents for us has primarily been the voice of confidence. You know, like you have the essentially the posture of the African American male before hip hop and after hip hop. You know, and before hip hop, it wasn't, you know, too many years before hip hop when a black man could be lynched for looking into the eyes of a white woman. And you know, now in hip hop, you know, or just even 10 years in hip hop ago, when cats were like just staring, bare chested with diamond necklaces, going what, staring at the face of anybody. That was essentially to me what hip hop was about. It was about finding the chant that would make us stand erect as a people. You know, it wasn't necessarily always the most progressive chant or any of those things. It was just essentially what was needed to make a bunch of cats feel confident enough in being themselves despite their, you know, financial being, historical being, or whatever, you know, just feeling like you could earn that respect. That's, to me, that's what it was about. And so that's the context that I put it in, more so than, you know, trying to point out how it's African or whatever. I think it's I don't know the importance of that as much as I feel the importance of pointing out what it's accomplished as far as achieving, you know, the articulation of confidence.
No, that's the answer I wanted to hear. Exactly. What about musically? I mean, how would you distinguish the native drumming of Africa compared to the drumming of Americas? Because there's a
Well,
difference.
musically, yeah, the difference that I feel is primarily that, you know, when I think of hip hop, I don't think of just African polyrhythms. I think of Native American drumming, which is often depicted as much more sparse. And if you mix the sparse Native American drummings with the polyrhythmic, dense, you know, more West African drumming, if you put that together, then instead of the brrr or the boom, 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 you'd have the which is hip hop, you know. So it's a mixture of those worlds, you know. Like that's why I don't point to just that. I don't think if it happened in America, it happened because of the Europeans here, as well as the Africans here, and the Native Americans here, and the trees here, and you know, the culture here. Like it's all of these things, you know. It's all of these things, and these things are a melting pot, essentially.
And of course, this week proved how far hip hop has come when Run DMC were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And now, for you personally,
Yeah,
with the hip
man.
hop, how do you feel? I mean, how do you feel about the significance of this induction?
Yo, that really exciting for us is like, you know, the little boy in me who grew up defending hip hop as music. Yeah, that was, you know, the way it went down at school, you know, the cats would be like, "It's not even music, he's just talking," you know, and we'd be like, "It is too music," you know, and so it's exciting to see those cats get recognized now.
Incredible. Incredible. Absolutely. I agree. I mean, how do you want to see your legacy understood for your vision, voice, and vocation when it's all said and done?
I imagine that I would simply want to be recognized as someone who achieved himself in his lifetime, you know. Whether that means speaking up, speaking out, or, you know, simply being, or spreading love, or helping build, or lending his hand, or lending his voice. You know, I just would like to be seen as someone who, you know, used his talent to help do what he felt was great. You know, you know, if I was good with working with my hands or whatever, you know, in some other capacity, I'd try to do the same stuff I'm doing based on the, you know, whatever skills or talents I have.
Right.
It turns out that, you know, most of the things I'm able to do are, you know, fall into the realm of, I guess, artistry or whatever. And so I'm just trying to do my part through that. You know?
Absolutely, absolutely. Most encouraging moment in your career so far, then, what would you say?
You know, it might have been a few years back when I was, the first time I toured South Africa was with Muta Baruka and Sarah Jones.
Okay.
And I had a reading in Johannesburg, and of course, because Muta Baruka was there, there was just this enormous turnout of just, you know, Naya Bingi, just crazy turnout. And I didn't know that there was a disc jockey named Rude Boy Paul who was playing my poem Shakrak Crack quite regularly on the radio station there for some time. And when I got up to speak for the first time in South Africa, I started reciting this poem and watched and heard as all these voices in the audience started reciting it with me. And it shook me, you know, as an African-American, feeling like words and thoughts and feelings, you know, could reach overseas in that way. And not in a general sense, like I'd actually grown up with my parents being activists. In relation to, you know, the anti-apartheid movement, and, you know, in our household, we had boycotted all sorts of products, and, you know, and when Serafina was, you know, when the cast of that play was exiled, and they were on Broadway, like, I saw that play 7 times, there was just a connection that I felt to that country in particular, and having that experience there was really a gift for me.
Incredible, incredible. I would imagine that being, yeah, pretty inspiring.
Definitely.
We've got a few. Yeah. We've got a few listener questions, Saul. If it's okay, I know it's been a very long feature, but absolutely, people are really appreciating your time out there.
No problem.
We've got Rough Styles from Cardiff, and he's asking, "What do you think of the Zeitgeist Dependum, and the forecasted predictions for the year 2012.
2012. All right. Well, I pretty much subscribed. My birthday is on leap year, which means that I am pretty much a victim of the Gregorian calendar. And so I've always looked at time and the calendar in a questionable way. When I look at 2012, I think in order to gain a holistic perspective of it, one of the things you have to keep in check is cynicism and fear, you know, and realize that all that is pointed in the direction that is inward and upward and beyond is safe, you know, even if it feels like the end of everything. So that I think it's not a question of an end of time. Now, he asked about Zeitgeist Addendum, and I might start by saying I have not watched the Zeitgeist Addendum, but I'm just giving my opinion of 2012. Mm-hmm. I think that that there is, you know, as who is it, Jose Arguelles? What's his name? An author who talks about the time in the technosphere, and he refers to the technosphere as the realm of reality that corresponds with what we believe in. Essentially, reality is based upon agreement, you know? Mm-hmm. And so if we all agree that something is real, then lo and behold, now it is. because we've determined that it is, and we've invested our belief system. You know, like that investment does yield results. You know, it becomes matter, it becomes a reality, even if in a broader scale, it's a lesser reality, it's malleable. You know, if we have invested that much belief into it, then we're forging its existence for it. You know, because belief has its power, because focused thought has its power, because all of these things have their power. But the technosphere is not the end all. Beyond that would be the new sphere, and the new sphere is the realm of existence that is, whether you believe in it or not. And that's the spot that we're all stepping into, that spot of clarity and understanding that knows that we are all interconnected, that knows that we are all one, whether the churches teach it or not. You know? And so within that understanding and within that greater understanding that so many of us are stepping into as we find the courage to step away from whatever we're born into and find the courage to question our teachers and authority and say, look, anything you're teaching us other than we are all one is warfare. Stop it. You know? So that when you begin to realize, you know, just with a Taoist, you know, sense of clarity, how things must be kept into perspective, whether that's nationality, whether that's an idea of race, an idea of gender, an idea of religion, or how all these things can yield their fruit and can be, you know, helpful in your growth process and in your yearning to, you know, accelerate your growth and in your yearning to speak up for a disenfranchised group, that they can all be helpful, but even that has to be kept into perspective because, you know, we are all just, you know, spirits passing through and share that common connection. So anyway, 2012 was that time where most of us or many of us step into that realization, and those of us who don't, we'll see, you know, how that plays out. I don't think it's any more violent than those of us are imposing upon. You know, like, it's hard to say. I just watched the film Knowing, you know, and we are consciously and constantly investing in this idea of an end of times, and thus, you know, playing our part in conjuring it. And so it depends on how many people invest and how many people outvest, you know, what happens. But hey, we successfully elected Obama here in the States. Mm-hmm. So, like I said, as long as you keep cynicism and fear in check, everything's cool.
We've got so many questions. We'll just go to one more. Charles Muga asks, have you read the book, The Secret? And if so, what do you think about it?
You asked me about The Secret on air. That's what I think about The Secret. You know, The Secret ain't a secret no more. The Secret is what I just said. It's about manifestation. That's what I was just talking about. And no, I haven't read the book. I saw the movie, but before I saw the movie, we had lived the life and spoken the word. You know what I'm saying? Like, it is what it is. It's simply realizing that what you say matters, i.e. becomes matter. Word up. Word is bond. We've known it all along.
Right.
That's the secret. You know, is maintaining the fullest harmonious, you know, state of being within a lifetime, you know, and yielding compassion and being mindful of your actions and yes, doing unto others and yes, sharing and giving and loving and achieving and driving and lifting and, you know, all of those things, growing, you know, challenging yourself beyond your comfort zones and realizing the interconnectedness of that and your perspective, you know, realizing that if you label yourself as a cynic and you're always expecting the worst, then you are conjuring the worst. You know, once you realize that you play a role in defining and defining your reality, then you know that you have to lift your head and consciously choose,
yeah,
you know, better than.
Yeah.
And you do that combining everything you say in small talk and big talk, you know.
Yeah.
And it's not a secret anymore.
Absolutely, man. Listen, it's been a real pleasure. We thank you so much, Saul Williams. I think everybody who's in tune and everybody will hear the podcast on iTunes, etc. Really appreciate your time this evening. I wish you all the best this year, and hopefully we'll speak again at some point throughout the year.
All right. Thanks,
Saul.
Take care. Saul Williams.